through the Weekly Pulse Sunday. I'm Jeff Snyder, founder and CEO of The Morning Pulse, and I'm joined by my co-host this week from Arizona, host of the Money Savage podcast. It's Mr. George Grombacher. George, say hello.
Well, hey, everybody.
I'm doing the applause. And also joining us from the great New York, New York, we've got Miss Natalie Walters. She is the tech reporter with The Motley Fool. Natalie, how are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, it's great. Guys, it's been an up and down week with the market, and it's been a, you know, up and down week with the weather. How are you all doing?
You know, I unfortunately don't experience weather in Arizona. It's either hot or it's perfect, but I thought it was a fascinating week with dogs and cats living together, with Kanye West getting falling in love with Donald Trump, and the leaders of North and South Korea coming together. Ford is stopping making cars, so I don't know what's up or what's down.
Yeah, I feel like there's been so much news this week. I feel like I haven't seen enough of the weather in New York. I couldn't really tell you what happened. I feel like I haven't been outside enough.
Well, we need to eventually, when we get big enough, we need to do what they do on all the major networks, is have like an outside studio. So when, I think when the podcast grows and we start having millions of listeners, I think we'll probably get to that point. And that'd be really great. So that way we can have, like, you know, it's like taking classes outside.
Perfect.
I guess until we get there, we're going to be stuck in our respective offices and locations. So boo hoo hoo us. It could be worse.
We'll just do the best that we can.
I'd love a field trip, a destination podcast.
Okay.
There you go.
Where do you think we should go?
Ooh, I'm thinking Bahamas.
Okay, good, yes.
Okay.
That's my vote.
I like Perfect. That. Are there no hurricanes this time of year, though, right?
I don't think this is hurricane season. I think it's a little later, right?
I don't possess that knowledge.
Like in August. Yeah.
Jody and I are planning a honeymoon. So we're trying to figure out exactly. Hopefully she's not listening to this, but we can find a spot that's not going to be near hurricanes. It's not going to be too extreme, and I can just relax after the wedding.
Nice.
I just got back from Thailand, and that is well worth your time.
Very cool. George, you had another suggestion?
No, I think that those are all excellent. So,
okay. Well, what do you say we all get started?
Let's do it.
All right.
Yes, let's do it.
So, Natalie, it's a big week in tech. I know you've got a lot of news, and we're going to go right into our first guest in the next few minutes. But what's going on from the tech side? What are you seeing in the market?
Yeah, the tech earnings have been better than we all thought. I think there's been, you know, kind of a negative stigma about tech right now, but it's not affecting their financial results to the chagrin of some, but obviously I'm sure tech companies are feeling pretty smug about that. The big highlights this week were Facebook and Amazon. Amazon in particular, their revenue rose 43% year over year, which is crazy, and they more than doubled their profit. So Amazon is coming in hot this week, yeah. And a curious thing is that they raised the price of their Prime membership for the first time since 2014. It's now going to be $119 per year in the U.S., which is very interesting to me. And it'll be interesting to see if they get any backlash for that. I mean, it'd be hard to see people being upset about that just because there's so many benefits. I think everyone thought $99 was pretty cheap for it. So raising it $20, I don't see that deterring too many people from keeping up the Prime membership. So what about you guys? Does that affect, I don't know if you'll have Prime membership, but does that bother you guys?
We are members of Amazon Prime, and I don't know what the number is that I would pay, but it's way higher than $119. So
Yeah, same.
I would say, I think, Netflix raised their membership rate, monthly rate, a year or 2 years ago, and that kind of met with some outcries. I think anytime you raise rates and you do it around a time that you have tremendous profitability, you know, people are always going to sing the blues a little bit. So I think we'll have to, I guess, watch and see what happens. But you know, I guess we'll have to see what the impact is ultimately on Prime. But, you know, the reality is you have to look at what competitors there are to the service and whether or not and what the benefits are to what you mentioned earlier, Natalie. And I guess we're going to – and George, I think we're going to have to figure that out along the way. We're only time will tell.
Yeah, like you said, they're offering it at a time when they're increasing the value of it. I mean, they've started offering more grocery delivery services, and they're working with Whole Foods. And in their annual letter last week, they said Prime members can expect more benefits later this year as they develop technology that will be implemented at the checkout at Whole Foods. They didn't get into anything specific, but, I mean, people could be seeing more savings at Whole Foods. So then that will more than make up for the extra $20 you're paying a year if you shop at Whole Foods. And then, of course, with their video content, they're upping that spend every year, getting better quality content every year. They're expected to spend $5 billion this year. I mean, that money, they have a ton of money, but it still has to come from somewhere. So hopefully Prime members will just see more and more value in their membership.
Yeah, and I certainly, as a user, I'm certainly not endorsing, and I know you guys aren't endorsing Amazon one way or another. We're just talking about the interesting work that they're doing, and we can't not talk about them because they're always seeming to be in the news. So
yeah, and I would say that, you know, what you just mentioned, Natalie, the content creation, that's kind of the brave new world. Amazon, the Netflix, the Hulus, the CBS Interactives, they all are creating this fresh content. And it'll be really interesting in our next segment, we're going to have Todd Mason on from Broadcast Management Group. His expertise is actually in the management and creation of these types of over-the-top networks. So I'm really fascinated personally, professionally, by the ability to create and deliver content to people. Because at the end of the day, and maybe Natalie, you have a perspective on this, we all want our own content. We want, you know, George has a different taste than I do. You have different tastes than I do. And so we all want our unique taste. So I think that's where these technologies are really going to come into play.
Yeah. I mean, like, everyone wants their own content and they want it when they want it. You know, they want to just be able to sign online, sign in on their phones and watch it right there. And I mean, this is a bit of a personal anecdote, but I was in Los Angeles a few weeks ago, only for 2 days, but in those 2 days, I overheard two in-depth conversations from production people talking about Netflix and how well it was doing and how they were either working at Netflix and loving it or they were trying to break into Netflix. And I thought that was so curious because I was only there 2 days, but it seems to be the talk of LA. You know, everyone's kind of trying to hook up, not so much with these traditional movie makers, but more so with these tech companies that have tons of money to throw at TV shows. I mean, Apple's teaming up with Reese Witherspoon for, I think, two shows that will be released in the next few years. So it's kind of a curious change to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
No doubt about it. And so many more platforms than there used to be. Just imagine 20 years ago, there were essentially three networks, and that's the content that you got. And then HBO came along, and there were a couple more. But today, there's dozens of these great places to put out content. Yeah. So,
yeah,
I think I saw that Netflix was releasing 700 titles this year.
Wow,
if I'm remembering that correctly. So yeah, I mean, it's crazy.
But none of which are on retirement. So I think we need some retirement-centric shows on Netflix and Amazon. So if I can make a suggestion, if any of those producers are listening, we've got some really good ideas, and we'd love to help out.
Retirement thoughts from the Bahamas coming at you weekly.
Yeah.
I love it.
That's right. That would be amazing. Go ahead, Nat. I'm sorry.
I was just going to suggest a title, How to Retire in the Bahamas.
Okay. Yeah.
There you go.
Boom.
There you go.
Yeah.
And for under $1 million, we definitely need help with people learning about retirement. So maybe there'll be an educational slot on either of those platforms. Natalie, in the remaining minutes, I know data privacy issues. We talked about Facebook last week, Cambridge Analytica, Equifax. Mm-hmm. We've been talking on the show a lot. What's going on the privacy side from your perspective?
Yeah, a really interesting case came up this week. I'm still stunned by the news because I've been following this case for years now. But Joseph D'Angelo was arrested on Tuesday for a series of 12 murders and about 50 rapes and about 120 burglaries that happened 1976 to 1986. So this is, you know, 40 years later, and they found him through DNA. And it's just a fascinating case to me. What they did was they had DNA of his from the crime scenes from the 70s and 80s that they've kept on file and just had there. And at the time, they didn't have the technology to do much with it. And but then around 1986, right when he stopped, is when DNA technology started to get better. And today, they were able to upload it to a genealogy website, and they were able to find some of his distant relatives and then track it back to him, because he was, they noticed that his age was about what the age they thought he would be, and he was living in the same areas where the crimes were happening at the times they were happening. And then they were able to legally get some of his DNA when he left, you know, say if he leaves a cup or a piece of discarded food in a public place, they are allowed to pick that up after he leaves and test it. And it was 100% match with the DNA they had from the 70s and 80s.
Wow.
And they were able to arrest him. So it's incredible. But of course, there's that issue now with privacy. And will this deter people now from using these websites that have become popular? For, you know, they show you your ancestry and give you information about maybe some diseases you might should look out for, stuff like that.
Interesting considerations we did not have to think about or concern ourselves with a couple of years ago, but now we certainly do. So
yeah, I'm feeling a little. You guys ever see the movie Minority Report?
Sure.
About 5 or 10 years ago, mm-hmm. That was a really really good movie. With Tom Cruise and Max von Sydow and some others. And it kind of feels like, you know, they were predicting people that would commit crimes, right, and arresting them.
Right.
Yeah, and it was based on a short story. So it's kind of like that apocalyptic, you know, I don't know if it's 1984-ish. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, crime doesn't pay, to quote Batman and Robin.
Yes.
And, you know, the reality is you know, that with the right technology, you know, you can be caught doing bad. So, you know, there's positives and negatives to that, unfortunately. Unfortunately.
I mean, yeah, there's so many cases, cold cases. I read that since 1980, there's 200,000 unsolved murders. So this could be used now to go back into those kits where the DNA was saved, and then upload it to genealogy websites and track it down, just like they did this one, and maybe they could solve some cold cases like that. And I think I think a lot of people are conflicted, because obviously we're so glad this person was caught. I mean, the victims, you know, some of them are obviously not here anymore, but a lot of their relatives are, and they finally feel like they have closure. But I guess it's just like the implications, and you know, what else could this be used for? And I think I saw that, you know, some of the more popular websites like Ancestry.com and 23andMe, I think they are the two most popular, and they did not work with law enforcement on this. But I think what happened is law enforcement used some smaller websites that, and maybe in their privacy clause that people agree to, it says, you know, we can use this in other ways as we want. And so people do sign off on that. So, you know, it was legal. And law enforcement, if you're looking for someone for 40 years, you're not going to risk him being freed on a technicality such as this wasn't a legal way to find him. So,
sure.
I mean, it was legal what they did.
So what I'm hearing you say is that I need to actually start reading my user agreements that I just clicked through. Because I'm not going to.
If you're giving out your DNA, then yeah, you should definitely be reading it.
All right. I think as we're going down a line that is definitely not podcast appropriate. Natalie, right. always a pleasure. But we know George is broke, but always a pleasure talking with you. And we'll look forward to having you back next week to talk about some of the hot topics in tech.
Yes, thanks for having me. Thanks for letting me go down my true crime rabbit hole.
Okay, you're quite welcome. Take care.
Take care. Bye, guys.
Bye. Well, that was quite a fascinating topic, George. I mean, you know, especially the content creation. I know that's a really kind of a new direction. We've got, you know, talking about Netflix and Amazon. And we're joined now by a great guest. He's the CEO of Broadcast Management Group, and he really specializes in the development, the creation and development of these over-the-top networks. Mr. Todd Mason. Todd, how are you, bud?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on your program, guys.
Well, thanks so much. I know George and I are excited, right, George?
I am for sure. It's a great topic, and I'm going to be honest. I needed to refresh my memory on exactly what OTT stood for before the show today. So over the top, I got it.
Over the top, yeah. I mean, Todd, you and I have known each other for a little bit, and maybe to start, maybe it'd be helpful just to quickly define what OTT is for the audience. Some people may not be familiar with the term.
Well, yeah, absolutely, Jeff. And George, that is something that I get all the time. You know, a lot of people ask me, what is OTT? And they look at me like I have two heads or I'm talking a foreign language. But then when I explain what it is, it's like, oh, of course, I knew what that is. And really, when you're talking about some of the people who you were speaking with before me, with Amazon and Netflix, I mean, really, Netflix virtually created OTT. So OTT is a platform of which you can watch audio and video content anywhere. So you can watch it on your smart TV, you can watch it on your mobile device, you can watch it on your desktop. So it's simply over the top television, or OTT, is is being able to view content, you know, where the consumer wants to view it. And that's why it's so incredibly popular. I mean, you hear the other term that you hear in addition to OTT a lot today is cutting the cord, or cord cutters, or neverers. And, you know, so neverers are people who, you know, the young generation that, you know, when they get out on their own, they've never had cable TV on their own. They've never subscribed to cable TV. And cord cutters are, of course, those that have cut the cord, and they're no longer subscribed to any cable service because they feel like they can get all the content they want via OTT.
Wow, I mean that seems to be where things are going, George and Todd. I mean, you know, really, you know, I know I have preferences, things that I like to watch, whether it's Star Trek: The Next Generation or tuning into, you know, the financial news networks. I always want to find things that are really things that I'm thinking about and looking for. And, you know, Todd, can you give some examples other than, I think you've worked with some OTTs recently to set up. Do you have a few examples you can kind of talk about outside of Netflix and Amazon?
Absolutely. I mean, the OTT world, which is still relatively new and a little bit of the Wild Wild West, there are a lot of opportunities for things to be defined. Like, for example, I mentioned a lot of cord cutters. You know, the challenge is there's more and more content available via OTT, growing every day. It really started with entertainment, with like Netflix, Hulu, Amazon. You know, those were some of the pioneers in the entertainment area. And then following that was in sports. So most of the networks are developing, you know, sports OTT channels. ESPN has multiple OTT channels. We helped, as far as a recent client, CBS Sports, and launching an OTT channel. And one of the things that is really exciting right now that I find that's really just starting, and that is OTT for more of industry and corporate clients. And so one of our other recent clients was Flywheel. So Flywheel is like SoulCycle. And so it's a proprietary bike, and you have an instructor that you can watch via OTT platform on your bike in your home, and it can be live or it can be on demand. So that's an example of an OTT platform. Then in the financial markets would be TD Ameritrade Network. We worked with them to launch a channel for them last year that launched in October. So now brands can go direct to the consumer with their message, whether it's entertainment, news, education. In TD Ameritrade's case, it is providing a unique vehicle for serious investors, individual investors, and institutional investors for education and news.
And if I may, from a corporate standpoint, will, and your example of TD Ameritrade, do they distribute it through their website, or where do people find it?
Well, that's a good question too. There are lots of ways to do that, and I'm sure you've heard of Cheddar, which they're an OTT platform as well. But they are expanding their distribution in several areas. So their options for TD Ameritrade, when we were first discussing that, it was really do we make the content available only to those who subscribe to the TD Ameritrade platform? So if you're using the TD Ameritrade trading platform, we're built into that platform, the network, and you can watch that network. You can also watch on while you're trading CNBC if you want. But if you want to watch the TD Ameritrade network and get the latest news as well as education on how to be a better investor and how to optimize the platform and your investment strategies, you can do that while you're in the platform. The other way you can do it is you can go to TDAmeritradeNetwork.com and watch it on the web. So initially we're looking, do you just want to make it to your subscribers, or do you want to make it more broadly available? And there are pros and cons of both, and that's really a individual corporate decision. You can make it as exclusive content when it's in a closed network, but the plus of an open network is you're tapping into new prospective clients, people that may not be using your service at that time, but they discover the network and they discover the value of that organization, and then they start using your platform. Recently at TD Ameritrade, we started simulcasting on Facebook and Twitter, which are also great platforms to expand our audience. You could also work out a distribution with Apple TV or Roku. So there are a lot of different options on distribution to explore, and it really is based on our individual client and walking through those strategy options.
Got Todd, it. How long does it take from soup to nuts, beginning to end, to set up a network like this? Like in the case of TD, how long did that take?
Okay, well, they were an exception to the rule. We are the foremost experts in OTT and producing content for OTT, which is an expertise that's unique because the way you produce content for OTT is in some ways it's similar to any other network, but there are also advantages of the live interactivity that you can have with OTT that you don't really get so much with live traditional broadcasts and cable. So you want to produce the content to optimize that advantage. And so we have particular expertise of that. We also have an expertise because we were one of the early pioneers in the area of OTT for producing for OTT, but also launching channels. And before OTT, we were helping traditional networks launch channels. So we know a lot about launching and operating, managing and producing content for a channel, whether it's traditional or OTT. So we can turn them around relatively quickly. But usually the holdup is on the client end because, it's OTT is often, a large client like TD Ameritrade or an Amazon, and their processes to go through, and sometimes that can take a long time. Big companies sometimes move a little slower. TD Ameritrade was really committed to be the first to market in their sector with an OTT channel, and they were very committed to doing that and whatever is necessary. So we did it in 7 months. So from the first meeting to the first on-air show was 7 months.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing. One area, you mentioned TD being the first to market first to market for an OTT for financial markets. But I got to believe that there are other opportunities. I mean, George and I cover the retirement space. There are many of us who cover the retirement space, and we think that and I don't want to speak for George, but education is really top of mind for us. How to get people engaged, thinking about retirement, thinking about saving and planning and college savings. I mean, that's got to be a great opportunity, don't you think, Todd, for an OTT type of network?
I totally agree with you. It is not being done right now. It is an open opportunity. There are, you know, as you know, there are over 113 million individual investors who have retirement plans with a cumulative market, you know, value that's in the billions. So that I think is around 27 billion.
Trillion.
Right,
I think it's about
trillion. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Slightly different.
Billion's
yeah.
nice, but
right.
trillion's better.
Trillions is better. But I mean, that is a huge market. That's individuals. And then you have, you know, those professionals like yourself that work in that market. So I see, you know, OTT opportunity for both working with individuals, providing them unique news and education related to retirement and investing strategies, and also for those professionals. So that's two distinct channels that could potentially have some overlapping content, but I think a lot of the content would be unique to that audience.
Awesome stuff. Excited to see what happens in the future. A lot.
Well, I think you're going to see, you know, TD Ameritrade was first to market in their space. I know a number of their competitors are looking at launching their own channels, and they'll put their own spin on it. And I don't think it'll be an oversaturated market. I think, you know, each, if done properly, each one will have their unique slice of the market. And you're talking about domestic. There's also international. And you look at for brands that are international, you know, with traditional cable and broadcast, it takes a long time to build your distribution. But in OTT, you can instantly be an international network and channel and reach those audiences. So that's another huge opportunity for TD Ameritrade and all the others that are in that space. And you look at other brands as well, whether it's healthcare providers, pharma, big opportunity for pharma, retailers like Amazon is already pursuing OTT right now, but look at Walmart, Home Depot, et cetera. It's a market to watch for sure.
Todd Mason, the CEO of Broadcast Management Group. Thank you for coming on, sir.
Thank you both. I really appreciate your time, and thanks for the invitation, Jeff and George.
Welcome back. Had a great segment on OTT, which for the uninitiated, which was me, means over the top, with Todd Mason, the CEO of Broadcast Management Group. Joining us now are the very popular Kevin Kelly of Bloomberg, the also very popular Oliver Rennick of TD Ameritrade
hey.
Networks, to talk about the market. Fellas, you got your Yeezys on today, or did you throw them away? Oliver, we'll start with you.
Traded. I'm waiting until Yeezys are publicly traded to opine. But, hey, you know, glad to be back as always, guys. Glad that the whole gang is back together. So happy to talk some markets. Right now, it's been a pretty busy just slew of information, lots of inputs this week. Not sure we got a lot of answers. I mean, there was a ton of stuff from economic data and GDP that we got today. There was a lot on the earnings front, of course. I mean, just a massive week for earnings. And, of course, we also hit bond yields at 3% on the 10-year. So a lot to tackle, but I think my main takeaway is that you have a market that just continues to really make it challenging for investors to find a narrative that is outside what's been the narrative really for much of the market rally. As frequent as we hear about the importance of yields climbing and the expectations for inflation and everything, at the end of the day, a lot of this market still looks exactly the way it has pretty much all along. Right now, what that has led to is a continued relative performance of growth companies versus those that some people call quote-unquote value. We basically saw a lot of excitement around those big FANG names, right? I mean, Facebook delivered just a massive quarter. Amazon was trading this morning at all-time highs before coming back, but also just massive quarter as well. A lot of concerns about the tech and chip space were put to bed, not so much for the Apple supply chain, but there's just a lot that is very consistent with how the market has been. But sentiment is what remains very different. So what kind of market that leads to, I don't know. But so far, the 3% yield market looks kind of a lot like the same.
Yeah, and it's very much so, you know, an earnings-driven market. We know that. We've talked about that. And when you look at, you know, where expectations were for, you know, I'll use the U.S. here, for the S&P 500 in the beginning of the year versus where we are now. I mean, surprisingly, they have these very high, lofty expectations. Analysts did for where they thought, you know, the first quarter was going to end up. And, you know, 9 out of the 11 sectors in the S&P 500 have actually surpassed that, or at least on pace to surpass that, if things continue going the way they are. So it could be a little confusing for investors who, you know, maybe pull up a price chart of the S&P 500 and say, how can, you know, this dominant first quarter be happening when stock prices aren't moving? And I think a kind of a key takeaway for your listeners is you have to remember that the stock market is a discounting mechanism, right? So, you know, if Amazon grew, to Oliver's point, Amazon had a massive quarter, you know, flexing their muscles, showing that they, you know, they can be profitable when they want to, in a sense. But you have to remember, you know, Amazon, you know, their stock price could easily have dropped, similar to what happened to Caterpillar after a good quarter, where, you know, you have executive commentary coming out or, you know, guidance coming out saying this may be, you know, peak earnings, so to speak, or don't expect this type of growth moving forward. That gets factored into a lot of whether it's analyst models or just the way in which people interpret where the market will be moving forward. It is a discounting mechanism. So it's trading based on future expectations of growth, of cash flows, of things of that nature. So it's easy to, I guess, get confused. And that's not to say we have all the answers by any means, but it is easy to you know, look at prices and say things should be different. But you have to remember, you know, we've been in this environment of, you know, high growth, high earnings, you know, for the last, you know, at least 12 months or so now. And people may be getting a little skeptical and saying that that run up that we had in, you know, through late January was a lot of this earnings expectation already being priced in. So the recent price action's more so kind of a pullback from that as kind of the buy the rumor, sell the news, you know, takes hold.
Yeah, to jump in on that, I mean, Kevin's dead right and referencing, I think, Caterpillar in there somewhere where CEO basically kind of hinted that this would be a watermark quarter. I wasn't sure what exactly that meant, but to Kevin's point, what he's essentially saying in a very educated CFA way is that the market now consensus is that, you know, it's difficult to continue to maintain that growth, which is kind of the, which another way to say that is that the risk is somewhat to the upside, and I guess what I would say where we that does show up is, you know, we had these incredible numbers that were expected, and right now all those numbers are largely being matched. I haven't really seen a big comprehensive guidance aggregate. Maybe Kevin's got something there, but it looks, as far as I can see, that those full year guidances that were issued are largely in line with what analysts had expected when they ramped things up in the first quarter. So when you have the risk to the upside, well, you know, what could then provide that risk? Because as Kevin points out, if you have a market that is, you know, pricing based on the future returns, future cash flows, et cetera, a underpricing of how big those flows and revenue could be is what then would be out of consensus. And I think that I wrote something about this last night, and I think there's a very real possibility that we could indeed see that, just because there's some interesting numbers that have come out. Bloomberg did a great article today assessing where changes are happening in the first quarter, perhaps based on tax cuts. And there's been a big talk about whether or not it's going to be buybacks or dividends and capex. And the increase on a yearly rate is pretty impressive in terms of what companies are spending. And a couple of years back when I was at Bloomberg, we did a story on a Bank of America report talking about how investors have shifted their preferences and they want companies to spend on capex. If that's the case and they reward those companies, then the idea that a blueprint sort of economic cycle that we're tempted to use may not apply when you have this sort of late stage injection of you know, sort of corporate liquidity, if you will. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens over these next 6 months for sure.
Guys, any, you know, fixed income? I know we've been talking a lot about companies. And obviously, Kevin, you're an equity strategist. But, you know, anything from the Federal Reserve in terms of interest rates? Many pension funds, endowments, foundations have a complex portfolio allocation, some of which includes fixed income. Any additional thoughts or sentiments from recent Fed comments, or at least what you're seeing with treasuries and yields, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, being the equity guy, why don't I jump in there first?
Yeah, I was going to say.
It makes sense. No, absolutely, sense. Though. I mean, I think we're still on pace for the 3-4 rate hike target this year. And that obviously would boost the front end of the yield curve. So, you know, 2-year yields would push higher. And that's something we've been watching, obviously. You know, the way in which yields really affect our market, the equity market, is when you look at valuations and the relative attractiveness. I think we spoke about this maybe in the first couple of weeks, the relative attractiveness of, you know, equities versus versus bonds. So, again, Fed comments, I think 3-4 hikes. There was, as Oliver mentioned, some data that came out this morning, some economic data that came out. You had what's called an employment cost index, which essentially looks at, it's just a different way of looking at wages, benefits, things of that nature for employees. That ticked higher. So you are starting to see some of this wage pressure kind of build in to inflation expectations, which should push up bond yields. So, I mean, we're at that 3% level. You know, kind of critical level everyone's been talking about. You know, it could go either way. So I won't speculate exactly, you know, where yields will go, but the possibility to the upside, especially with a lot of, you know, new bonds coming to the market, so your supply is increasing, which will pressure yields higher. You know, you could see the 10-year run away a little bit. And the threat there, you know, final comment, the threat there is that if the Fed moves too quickly, and yields kind of stay, you know, where they are anchored, threaten what's called that yield curve inversion, where you have higher short end rates, and that has been a great predictor of recessionary time. So, from what I'm hearing, you know, it's pretty much, you know, we're in the clear for the next year or so. But when you get into 2019, especially 2020, a lot of the risks to a recession really start to jump up.
One thing that I think is really important for your world, Jeff, is with regards to pensions along that front, is kind of the effect of everything Kevin just went through. So what does that mean for money managers? What does it mean for pension fund managers? And well, what it means is that if they have been in the past 4 years going to riskier parts of the bond market to capture yield because treasuries have not been offering that yield, then there could be a sort of a wave of reallocation within the bond market. Tom S. Safe, who writes the Sevens Report, was on our show, one of our shows this week, and he put this really well in a very practical way. Because we talk about all these things and the yield curve and this and that, and what does it mean? Well, basically it just means that now, instead of buying bonds because you think the next guy is going to buy them at a higher price because there's nothing else to buy around, people might consider, and investors and pension managers might consider buying bonds because of the guaranteed return that they offer. So that's important for a pension fund manager, as you well know, or any kind of institutional manager. But the only place they've been able to get a guaranteed rate that's decent enough has been in the riskier parts of the bond market. So what happens if we start moving higher on the riskless stuff? Well, a pension fund manager might say, look, I'm allocated this much to, you know, high yield. Well, I don't need to do that anymore. I don't need to take that risk because I can get it in a treasury, or I can get it in something less risky on the corporate side. And then so you have that push away from some of these higher yielding assets. And that then poses questions for risk in general. But whether or not there is a distinct, whether or not the level, the elevation of, say, the 10-year yield or the curve flatness or the speed at which the 10-year yield moves up, you can find just about one guy or gal on the street that is going to tell you which one of those is more important than the other. It's really going to come down to sort of each manager's risk and what they are currently holding, right? And we don't really see that happening too much right now. If you just look at the junk and high-yield ETFs and monitor this, I mean, they did get a pretty strong tick lower when we hit 3% on the 10-year. But for the most part, following a sharp downdraft in January and February, I mean, they've mostly held on. So you don't see that type of quote-unquote de-risking, people like to say to sound cool, happening quite yet in the market, but it's a very real possibility that it will.
And if I could just one more really quick comment there, because Oliver brings up a number of good points, is there may be a situation that, you know, you want people and your listeners to be aware of in which, you know, bonds and stocks start to move together. And we've started to see a little bit of that recently, especially if you get, you know, a shock to the upside on inflation. If inflation starts to pick up faster than most people are pricing in or most people are expecting, that could hurt stock prices. The stock prices could go down as yields are rising, which means bond prices are going down. So that, you know, that risk isn't necessarily at the forefront right now, but it is a situation that, you know, you want to be prepared for, because, you know, we have seen it in the past, and it is a possibility, even though over time you typically see, you know, stocks and bonds, that's why they're great diversifiers with each other or offset each other, because they tend not to move together. But it is a situation, you know, you want to be prepared for.
Excellent work, fellas.
Thanks, guys.
There we go.
Guys, have a great weekend. Enjoy the NFL draft. I hope you guys get drafted. with those great 40-yard dash times, and we will see you all next week for some more fun and markets.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Josh.
Great calls.
Bye, guys. George, you know, it's been a great show, and we've got our Legal Eagles, if you remember that movie. We've got our dynamic duo. We've got David Levine and Kevin Walsh, both from Groom Law. Guys, how are you this Friday afternoon?
It's a beautiful day here in Washington. What can we say? It's cloudy and wet, so it's a perfect spring day.
I thought David was totally lying when he said it was a nice day.
Yeah, apparently. Well, it's good to have you back on, and I know last we left you both, you were digging deep into those new fiduciary rules. But I think we've got a little bit of a different topic this week. I think you're still kind of coursing through that information, but ESG is on your minds, I believe.
It is. Go ahead, Kevin.
ESG is on our minds because I thought, you know, we were looking at a lull, and the lull was just nonstop SEC regulation best interest action combined with fiduciary rule updates combined with motions to intervene in the Fifth Circuit case. And what does the DOL do in the middle of that? But on April 23rd, they released a brand new field assistance bulletin that provides some guidance to kind of DOL's enforcement staff with respect to ESG. So when plans take environmental, social, or governance factors into account when making investment decisions. So I think David and I were planning on just kind of talking through a little bit of what the FAB says and kind of where, how we've gotten here. David, you want to talk a little bit about the background here?
Sure. And to add one note, Jeff, you were saying that we were digging on the SEC rule. We figured people might enjoy a break per week, so we thought we'd talk about something completely different to address it. We haven't forgotten. We figure we'll be back on that in a future week.
Absolutely.
But it's the ESG is kind of like the ups and downs, because I think to set the table for listeners, it really depends on where you are in the retirement plan universe. If you are part of a governmental plan, a big pension plan, or even a lot of the big states' defined contribution or city systems, you've probably been having ESG discussions for a while now. These systems have been at the lead. They're not subject to ERISA, but they've looked at the Department of Labor's guidance. But then you've been seeing an increased movement of discussion in the mega plan market and defined contribution plans, and even into the small with special ESG investment funds. And on the pension side, in the private area, you definitely see discussions of ESG popping up more and more. But what's happened is in the Bill Clinton era, they put out guidance on ESG saying it can play a role. Then in the George W. Bush era, what happened is that the George W. Bush administration, in a sense, throttled back ESG a little bit. And not surprisingly, later in the Obama administration, they opened it up a little bit and sort of made it, I think what someone might say, more flexible. Now we get guidance from the Trump administration that maybe steps it back a bit and says, tries to make it clear that ESG is not just an automatic green light, and we can talk about in a second, I'll hand to Kevin, but also it does get into some interesting discussions of like the role of ESG in a defined contribution plan. We live in a defined contribution world now, and it actually has a little bit more talk about ESG in that context. With that said, Kevin, you want to dive into some of the more nuanced pieces of it?
Sure. So I think the key point here is that both the Obama DOL and now the Trump DOL are saying that ESG can be a tiebreaker, essentially if all other factors are equal. So when you're initially thinking about it, you're thinking, okay, a tiebreaker. It might come into play more frequently. At the same time, though, one of the key tone shifts for the Trump Department of Labor is that the FAB has some words essentially cautioning fiduciaries against converting factors that are ESG factors into economic factors. So it doesn't use examples, but it's essentially cautioning against saying, you know, gun manufacturers are going to face, gun manufacturers will likely perform worse in the future because you could argue there's social harm there, or stock companies that harm the environment might face an economic harm in the future, kind of a generalized harm. So that was kind of not helpful if you were looking to make ESG investments, because for the past few years, one of the things that people have been able to kind of have attempted to document is that the ESG factors actually in the long run can be viewed as economic factors. The second kind of area here was when they look at the defined contribution plans. And here it talks about kind of in the QDIA context. And DOL kind of has a new novel concern, which could have a big impact on the use of ESGs as QDIA options. And that's the default option under a 401k plan. And for the most part, there haven't been a lot of ESG options in the private plan space that have been ESG. But here, the department points out that participants might have competing views on the collateral benefits of these ESG policies, and that it could implicate the fiduciary's duty of loyalty, essentially to the different participants with different aims. And I thought that was pretty interesting, David. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I wholeheartedly agree with you, Kevin. I think you said it perfectly.
The other thing that the Field Assistance Bulletin does is it talks about kind of shareholder engagement activities. And this goes beyond essentially when a plan makes a decision not to purchase something or to purchase something based on the secondary social goods it presents. But actually, once you own something, how you advance kind of societal interests.
Kevin, can you tell us a little bit about shareholder engagement as it applies?
George, that's a great question. And that's really the second half of what the Field Assistance Bulletin talks about. So the first half was all talking about essentially what plan fiduciaries should think about when they're buying or selling things. When they're taking these secondary environmental, social, and governance factors into account, the second half of the Field Assistance Bulletin relates to what fiduciaries should be doing or can be doing once they actually own something. And here, DOL acknowledges that in 2016, it indicated that, you know, proxy voting and shareholder engagement, that those are things that could be consistent with a fiduciary's obligation under ERISA. But here, where it starts departing from the prior guidance or where it starts throwing cold water on kind of shareholder engagement activities, is DOL notes that, you know, these types of things typically don't involve significant expenditure of funds. And then they go on to say that, you know, when we've said this before, we've never meant for plans to incur big expenses in these kind of advocacy efforts. And just that by itself would already throw some kind of cold water on this. But it goes further. And at the very end of the Field Assistance Bulletin, it cautions fiduciaries, you know, if you're going to expend funds doing these things, you should document your decision-making process. And to me, kind of where that gets scary is if they're telling you to document your process, it's almost telling you that at some point they might look into what your documented process was or what your decision-making was, and you could see the department second-guess some of these efforts. So, I mean, those are the big things that came out this week. It was a surprise that the department issued guidance related to basically environmental, social, and governance investing. But since it came up, it's been a topic that's been kind of ping-ponging for the past 25 years.
And Kevin, you make a great point. One thing that comes to mind for me is you talk about what does the future hold? Clearly for people who are in plans that are not subject to ERISA, we are looking at a world where they've put in places mainly governmental plans. And the question is, do they need to go back and update and revisit? The answer is their local laws really vary, but it's good to say, does this give any color that if they have an investment policy statement or other document that talks about ESG, how does this impact it? Because people will still look to the DOL. If you're in a private plan, the enforcement side, as you raise, is a very big point. The DOL enforcement has been very active, as many of us know, for many years on a number of topics, ranging from everything from late contributions to missing participants. The department could at some point add this to their list. So really having a clean process, thinking about not too prescriptive, but also about a process they can defend is more essential than ever. This is the classic, another item pops up in the game of whack-a-mole and how you do your fiduciary process. It's never static.
Never static. Well, David Levine and Kevin Walsh from Groom Law Group, well done, gentlemen. Thank you so much for your time. You guys have an awesome weekend.
Thanks for having us on. It was great again.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back. What a ton of great information from a ton of great guests again today, Jeff.
Yeah, I think it was good. I think we learned a lot of different things from, you know, just hearing what's going on in the tech sector in general led us to a conversation about over-the-top networks with Todd Mason and really focusing on financial services and the OTT networks and what the future kind of looks like. And then hearing about markets from our friends at TD Ameritrade and Bloomberg. And then lastly, wrapping things up with David and Kevin from Groom Law with this new fab on ESG funds. I mean, that's a very topical, very important topic, and one that I know that we're having conversations with clients. So it's been a great show, another great week. And we just got to continue to get better and improve and deliver good ideas to our to the audience.
That is 100% true, sir. And I know I'm 100% sure also that the world is going to keep providing us with fun and interesting content to try to make sense of. So
absolutely. Well, George, I wish you a really great weekend.
You as well, man.
I will. I'm going to have fun, and yeah, we'll talk to each other early next week to get this thing going.
Sounds good.
All right. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.